Paradise Radio. This is Henrik Palmgren, and I'm glad that you've tuned in to our program here today. We have a real treat for you as we are joined by Graham Hancock, a legend in the field of alternative research with books such as Fingerprints of the Gods, The Sign and the Seal, Keeper of Genesis, Talisman, and Underworld behind him. He's co-written a lot of books with Robert Buwal, who we also had recently with us on the program. I do hope that you're familiar with Graham's work. You should be. If not, this is an excellent time to get into it and familiarize yourself with his research. We are going to discuss some of Graham's earlier work later in the program, such as Fingerprints of the Gods and Talisman, but we are going to begin to talk about his latest book, Entangled, a novel, actually, and I'm curious to know why Graham has chosen to take this route, considering his past and excellent non-fictional work. Entangled carries a message, though, that can be found in, for instance, Supernatural. It's a tale of two women from two different times, destined to battle the forces of evil. It's the first book in a three-part series, and this is what we are going to talk more about here today. The website is simply grahamhancock.com. Go there for more information about the latest book Entangled, his previous works, and tons of other stuff. His website, including with his forum, is an excellent resource of exciting knowledge and research. Welcome to Red Ice Radio, Graham. Thank you for joining us. We are real excited to have you with us today.
Thank you, Henrik. It's a pleasure to be with you as well. Very nice to talk to you.
So tell us first a little bit about this decision of yours, Graham, to go into the area of novels. Have you shied away from doing non-fictional work now, or why?
No, I haven't. But I've been working as a non-fiction author, actually, for almost 30 years now. My first book that I ever wrote was a travel book called Journey Through Pakistan, which was published back in 1981. And so I'm coming up for close to 30 years of writing documentary factual books. And it wasn't until the late 1980s, 1988, 89, that I really began to work on a book that concerned a historical mystery. And that was The Sign and the Seal, a quest for the lost Ark of the Covenant. It was, if you like, my initiation into the realm of mystery and of what is hidden from us in our past. And I went on from there, and we'll talk about these later, to write books like Fingerprints of the Gods, and for example, Keeper of Genesis and Heaven's Mirror, and Underworld, which investigate the possibility that there may have been a huge forgotten episode in human history, a lost civilization, you know, by any other name, dating back, I believe, more than 12,000 years. So I really put my life on the line to create these books. I mean, Underworld, for example, involved 6 years of intensive scuba diving all around the world, down to depths of 40 meters in sometimes very severe currents, following up sightings and rumors of ruins submerged beneath the sea by rising sea levels at the end of the last ice age. So this was a very, you know, very in-depth research. And really, after I had completed Underworld, which followed long after Fingerprints of the Gods, I felt that in terms of the story, in terms of the investigation into a lost civilization, I had taken the work as far as I could go, and that there was a danger, if I continued, that I would become one of those authors who simply repeat themselves with every book. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want that to happen to me. For me, the lifeblood of writing is to be fresh and new, and to be working at the cutting edge rather than way back in the rear guard. And so I felt very strongly that it was time for me to move on. And I wasn't clear exactly where I wanted to go. I had one more non-fiction project that I really wanted to do, and this was the book that became Supernatural, which is quite a departure from my previous Lost Civilization work, and looks at shamanism and altered states of consciousness, and the notion that shamans, as Terence McKenna put it, may have kept the flames of a tremendous mystery burning, which our scientists have ignored. That there may be a secret doorway that we can open inside our minds and project our consciousness through into other freestanding realms and dimensions inhabited by intelligent beings. Well, the shamans call them spirits, and we call them other things in Western society. Mm. But this is the notion. And so that was, again, that book was published in 2005, and that was another big, detailed, factual investigation into mystery, you know, with 1,000+ footnotes and huge amounts of references. I hope it's a stimulating and controversial book, but it's also, you know, a very detailed, thoroughly researched book. Mm. Now, while I was writing, sorry, this is a very long preamble, but while I was writing and researching Supernatural, I had extraordinary experiences with what is called the Vine of the Dead, or the Vine of Souls. This is the shamanistic brew called ayahuasca that shamans drink in the Amazon, and it plunges them into a deeply altered state of consciousness, and onward from there into absolutely convincing parallel worlds. And in order to write about the shamanistic experience, I felt I needed to have that experience myself, and began to drink ayahuasca. I found it, I went to the Amazon, I sat down with the shamans, I learned from them, I drank the brew many, many times, and I've continued to drink it since the research on Supernatural. And back in 2006, at a series of sessions in Brazil, I set myself an intention. And this is often what we do with ayahuasca. When you're entering the spirit realm, you need to have an intention. Mm-hmm. And my intention was, I want to expand myself creatively. I want to try and explore some extraordinary ideas through the vehicle of fiction, through a novel. Mother Ayahuasca, can you give me a vision that will help me to see where I go? And I was given the most extraordinary series of visions over 5 sessions of ayahuasca in Brazil, which set me on the path that led to the writing of this novel. I was shown the essential element of the story, that there are 2 young women, one in the Stone Age, one today, and that they are entangled with one another in the quantum physics sense, that they're brought together to do battle with a demon who's traveling through time, that they must cooperate and work together to defeat this demonic force. It must be defeated both in the Stone Age and today in the 21st century in order to drive it away. And this was the heart of the story, and I saw many individual scenes, but more than that, it was as though I had downloaded from the spirit world an entire novel. And the process of writing it was really a process of rediscovering that download. Huh. So there's a very long answer to your very short question.
Well, that's really interesting. And I also want to ask you, obviously, obviously you've chosen still to be within the realm of your research, so to speak, but you keep it in a novel form now. And do you think that, have you gone down this route to target another audience as well? Maybe not target the regular, you know, choir, as it were, maybe, who are reading your books and are critical of your work and want to try to dissect it. This takes you into another area where you can be more free, so to speak.
Maybe. Yes, there's great freedom with fiction, and particularly with fantasy. And this novel is very much in the genre of fantasy adventure. There's great freedom there because with my non-fiction work, the academic critics, and I have many of them, in fact it seems that I have a devoted group of academic critics who follow everything I do, and really I wonder sometimes if they're paid a salary to do this because they seem to have so much time, and investigate minutely every statement that I make, and if they can find any weakness or any doubt at all over the statement, this is then elaborated and expanded out into a devastating critique, not only of my work, but also of me as a human being. And I'm just utterly dismissed as a human being that one should not even consider thinking about. This is the academic reaction to me. Well, what's great about fantasy and fiction is that they really cannot usefully throw those criticisms at me anymore, because the reaction is simply, hey guys, relax, it's just fiction, it's just fantasy, chill. But what I found is that in the realm of fantasy, it, for this very reason, it makes it possible to us, for us to explore extraordinarily interesting ideas that honestly simply could not be touched if they were being presented as nonfiction. Somehow our society is not ready, I have learned, for the exploration of certain mysteries if those mysteries are presented as being possible facts. Rather, we are ready to explore mysteries with our imagination, but we prefer not to be told that they are facts at the moment. It's as though putting the material into a fictional format gives us permission somehow from our society to look at things that we otherwise wouldn't have looked at. And for me, that's a great creative opportunity. You see, what I found with my nonfiction books, as this process of corrosive academic attack continued, and I should say I'm not against academics attacking me. This is a good thing that they do. It's a service. It requires me to up my game. It requires me to make sure that what I'm doing is the best standard it can possibly be. It's a kind of quality control mechanism, sometimes maybe motivated by personal or negative motives on the part of the individual concerned, but nevertheless, it requires me to address it and pay attention to it and adjust my work accordingly. And what I discovered as the years went by and as the academic criticism became more and more personal and intense was that I was you could almost say trying to bulletproof my arguments before I put them out there. And the result of this was that so I would support every statement with lots and lots of references and footnotes and repeat the facts and the details and the evidence so that people really got it. Mm. The result, however, and so that my critics wouldn't have that little angle to come in and say, oh, this is wrong, so everything in Hancock's work is wrong, as they repeatedly do. But the result of that process, and you can see it clearly in my book, Underworld, which is around about 800 pages long, was that I ended up writing at enormous length. And I fear that I was becoming increasingly boring by trying to respond to the academic environment. It made the lively and adventurous spirit that was at the heart of my work in Fingerprints of the Gods, it made it impossible to maintain that spirit by the time I got to Underworld in 2002. And I felt very strongly as a writer, I don't want to go on writing in this defensive mode. I want to be on the attack. That's my role. That's my job. That's what I'm here to do. I don't want to be defending myself in advance against anticipated arguments. And I suddenly realized, hey, it's very straightforward. Fiction is the way to go. I can work in the same realm of ideas, but I need not be defensive because I'm not saying this is fact. I'm saying this is a story. Enjoy.
So what is some of the reality behind the story then? I mean, for instance, with a demon army named Illimani, you know, in Entangled, what level of your previous work have you chosen to incorporate into this, so to speak?
Well, when I was researching Supernatural, really what set that book off, my last nonfiction book, what set that off was a mystery in the human story. And the mystery is this, that until about 40,000 years ago, there is no evidence that our ancestors, even though they were anatomically modern and looked exactly like you and I, there was no evidence at all that they were what we would recognize as human. Their behavior was almost unrecognizable as human behavior. There was no symbolism, no evidence of lateral thinking, no creativity, no sense of a world beyond this material world. These seem to be totally material creatures rooted and grounded in the daily struggle of life. And then suddenly, somewhere around 40,000 years ago, that's 40,000 years ago, it's as though a light is switched on in the human brain all over the world, pretty much at once. And you suddenly get this amazing phenomenon that is called cave art and rock art. Our ancestors begin painting scenes on cave and rock walls all around the world. And these scenes are not observations of everyday life, by and large. If you really get into them closely, you find that they are filled with fantastical elements and that there are strange beings and creatures depicted in the scenes. for which the technical term is therianthrope. That's from the Greek therion, meaning wild beast, and anthropos, meaning man. These are beast men, part animal, part human, depicted in the moment of transformation from one to the other. And this, of course, is the classic imagery of shamanism. We can find shamans in the Amazon today after drinking ayahuasca. When they return to normal consciousness, they too paint their visions, just as our ancestors did tens of thousands of years ago. And these paintings depict identical beings to the beings that are seen in the very ancient cave art. So I began to realize that this was an extraordinarily important moment in human history, and I did very much want to set part of my novel in the Stone Age. I didn't want to set the whole novel in the Stone Age because I wanted the story to travel in time, to move across time, to jump between two different times. But I thought this is an enormously interesting period when really it seems that there was a struggle for the soul of mankind. And for a while, it seemed that the creative side of ourselves, the beautiful side of ourselves, came out and expressed itself in this art. And then it disappeared again for a long time. And I projected the notion of an evil force, a demonic force. He's called Sulpa in the novel, and he leads a tribe called the Illimani. And in fact, he's a demon who has taken a human body. And what he wants to do, what he needs to do, he's taken a human body in the Stone Age, and his project is to manifest or materialize physically in the 21st century. And to gain power to do this, his project is to massacre innocence wherever he finds it. And the most innocent, the most beautiful humans in the world at that time, in the time my story is set 24,000 years ago, are not anatomically modern humans like you and I. They're the Neanderthal, who we meet early on in the story. Although my main character, Rhea, is an anatomically modern human being, she's interacting with the Neanderthals, who they call the Uglies in the story. And she's caught up with them for a reason, because this demonic force, Sulpa, what he's really seeking to do is to massacre and kill off the Neanderthals in the most horrible way possible. Because they are pure goodness, he will gain enormous psychic power from doing that. And so the novel becomes, in a sense, a struggle to prevent the extinction of the Neanderthals by anatomically modern humans. And of course, this is a debate that goes on to this day. Mm-hmm. Were the Neanderthals wiped out by anatomically modern humans, or did they die for some other reason? And it becomes a very important issue in the story that the Neanderthals must not be wiped out by anatomical human beings. Because if that happens, if the demon Sulpa has his victory in that respect, then that means he's here with us in the 21st century as well. And so it must be prevented. As you can see, there's a very different notion of the character of time in this novel than most of us work with, that time is not an arrow, that it doesn't flow simply from past through present to future, that perhaps all times in different realms coexist simultaneously like parallel worlds, that certain times are interlinked and connected, and that when they are, enormous potential for good and for evil is unleashed.
So do you think that, I mean, this, it sounds also a little bit like it's an apocalyptic theme here, obviously, and it has to do with the cyclical nature of time that you tie in the beginning, so to speak, and now then potentially we can say that we're at the end of this cycle as well, and this is just how the story kind of ties together, I guess.
There is indeed an apocalyptic theme to this story, and of course, as you know, the book Entangled that you have in your hands is the first book of a series of books which will explore this adventure much further, but I won't be giving too much away if I say that it does ultimately bring us close to apocalyptic events in our time, and that it is essential to prevent those events in our time, to prevent them reaching the horrible state that they might reach, to put things right in the past, and that is what these two characters are doing. So the different view of time is that you can readjust the past, and it is that project which the novel is all about, really, about a fight of good. It's a battle of good against evil, the evil force has a particular aim, which must be frustrated if he is not to destroy all of human potential forever. That is the jeopardy. That's what's at stake here.
I'm also reminded of the when you did your television series back with, I think it was Channel 4, you showed this beautiful depiction at Angkor Wat of these two armies, so to speak, that are churning the Milky Way. The
Milky Ocean.
And it is on that theme, isn't it? It's the same story in one way that you're telling.
Well, I suppose so, because that's a demonic and an army of demons and angels confronting one another. Where I took it, I suppose where I take it further in Entangled is the notion, you see, the force of good cannot interfere directly in human affairs. It can only work through human consciousness. And that's why these two young women, the heroes of the story, are so important. There is an angel, the Blue Angel, who is locked in this cosmic battle with the demonic force Sulpa. But in order to succeed in that battle, she cannot defeat Sulpa directly on the human plane. That has to be done by human beings. It's our ultimately, there's a philosophical point behind this, that we as human beings have a special predicament, different from all other life on this planet. And that is that we have the power to recognize and to choose between good and evil. That it's our responsibility. The matter is not out of our hands. It's totally in our hands. And in this novel, I place it in the hands of two vulnerable but courageous young women who make that choice, who make the choice for good and set themselves against the evil in both time frames to save humanity from a terrible cataclysm.
And you also have a little bit of the story in terms of I guess the use of drugs as well as an entry point.
Very much so. And this, of course, is bound to be seen as a controversial aspect of Entangled. I would say this is perhaps the world's first DMT novel, or ayahuasca novel as well, or psilocybin novel, because the dimethyltryptamine in its pure form. Dimethyltryptamine in its place within the ayahuasca beverage, and psilocybin mushrooms all feature strongly in this story. And the reason they feature strongly in this story, well, first and foremost, of course, my own background research in supernatural into shamanism all around the world. It's a fact. Of course, there are other techniques for getting into altered states of consciousness. Rhythmic dancing for very long periods of time, 40 days of fasting, even certain kinds of austerities and pain, as in the Native American sun dance, will put you into an altered state of consciousness where spirit realms become accessible. But still, the majority of shamans in the majority of tribal and hunter-gatherer societies that survive in the world today, the main mechanism that they use for entering parallel realms is indeed visionary plants, which we call, of course, hallucinogens in our society. And our society has been brainwashing us with propaganda for more than 40 years now, propaganda that emerges from very specific material interests on the part of specific groups, mainly in American society. And this propaganda is called the war on drugs. And it's rather like the war on witches in the 16th century. Adults who responsibly decide to explore their own consciousness, not somebody else's, using sacred plants that have been in honorable use in human culture for more than 10,000 years, for sure, we have the archaeological evidence that adults who make that responsibility to explore in the inner sanctum of their own consciousness may yet in our society face the threat of being sent to prison for doing so. To me, this is a modern witch hunt.
Yeah.
It is as irrational, as cold, as vicious, and as cruel as the persecution of witches in Europe in the 16th and 15th centuries and before. And the damage it causes to our society, this so-called war on drugs, is equally great. It's not the drugs that cause the damage. It's the war on drugs that causes the damage. If we want adults to responsibly use drugs, we must provide them with information about drugs that tell the truth. And part of the problem is that government propaganda campaigns on drugs have lost all credibility, particularly with young people, and nobody believes them anymore. I accept that some drugs are extremely harmful, but I do not agree that the way to prevent people taking them is to make them illegal and to subject those people to huge periods of time in prison.
Right, right.
The issue of tobacco, which of course is a highly addictive drug, has shown us for sure that if you give people good information that they believe, and it's important they believe it, about the health risks of a particular herb, they will stop using that herb. So there, without anybody ever being sent to prison, there's been a dramatic reduction in the number of tobacco smokers in the industrialized countries simply through the exercise of free choice on the basis of good information. Of course, the opposite story is true with the illegal drugs, where there has been a huge increase in their consumption despite 40 years of persecution and very invasive policies. So where I come from on this is that if I, as an adult, am not sovereign over my own consciousness, if I live in a society that does not allow me to have the keys to my own consciousness, then I can't claim to be free at all in any way.
Yeah.
And it's utterly pointless for me to talk and admire the achievements of democracy in the West, where that very democracy is, for example, in the United States, arresting 700,000 people a year for smoking marijuana and destroying their lives. Because once you are arrested for one of these so-called crimes, you have a record which operates against you for the rest of your life. Do we really want to inflict that kind of misery on people? Can't we find a better way forward? Can't we actually learn the lesson of tobacco? And above all, can't we recognize that certain of these so-called drugs, and I speak particularly of the visionary plants here, which are used in shamanistic cultures all around the world, that certain of these plants have an enormously constructive and positive role to play for the human creature, a creative and nurturing role, not a deadly, dangerous, dark, and awful role, but a very, very positive role. So I believe strongly that it is part of our birthrights as adults, and I emphasize as adults, this is not a matter for children.
Sure.
It is part of our birthright to explore the consciousness that this amazing universe has given us. We must not be told what to do with our consciousness by the state. It is not the state's business what we do with our consciousness. It's our business alone. Only if a change in our consciousness then causes us to get into the face of other people and cause trouble to those other people, do I accept that the state has a role. But to put somebody in prison for exploring their own consciousness with sacred plants, to me that is a gross breach of human rights, and it is morally repugnant in every possible way. And I will remain a campaigner on this matter for the rest of my days. I think fundamentally it is a human rights issue. So yes, Entangled, my novel, does include quite a lot of information, quite a lot of scenes that involve DMT, dimethyltryptamine, that involve psilocybin. It's psilocybin mushrooms that the Stone Age characters use to enter parallel realms. And in the modern character Leonie, She takes part later in the story. Her first initiation is through a near-death experience, as you know. But she then takes part in a scientific project giving DMT to human volunteers, and this takes her further. And that, of course, is based on the work of Dr. Rick Strassman at the University of New Mexico. Rick is one of the few scientists who's been allowed to work with human volunteers and dimethyltryptamine. He did a six-year study at the University of New Mexico, and he reported his results in an amazing book called DMT, The Spirit Molecule. And the conclusion that this leading mainstream scientist comes to is really quite stunning, because he found that all of his volunteers, although not comparing notes, were meeting the same entities in the same landscapes during their journeys on DMT. And normally, when we humans all see the same thing, we tend to agree that it's real. And so he started to ask himself, could it be that these realms that my volunteers are going into with DMT, could it be that those are real also? Could we be dealing with the ultimate mystery of quantum physics here? Could this be a way for us to put our consciousness into parallel universes? And it's that very exciting idea that's also at the heart of Entangled. And it's precisely why I use these sacred drugs as the vehicle to get my characters into and out of the parallel realms where they can actually meet out of body and interact with one another. But I realize it's a controversial area. I know that there will be some knee-jerk reactions to this, but I think it's the role of the fiction writer to explore controversial areas and throw them open for discussion.
Absolutely. Why do you think it is an important story to tell? I mean, again, if we go back to that idea that you mentioned, that you basically asked the spirit, if we can call it that, for a story to tell, so to speak, and this is what came forward. What do you think is the important elements here that our society or civilization today needs to hear that is contained within the story?
I think, that one of the most important elements of Entangled is the mystery of consciousness, that we cannot be at all sure that our consciousness is simply generated by our brains, the way that, a factory makes cars. That is the general view of materialist scientists, and almost all scientists are ultimately reductionists and materialists at heart. They want to weigh, measure, and count things. And if they can't weigh, measure, and count it, then as far as many scientists are concerned, it doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. But scientists are up against a problem with consciousness. In fact, they call it the big problem, because they haven't really figured out what consciousness is. They don't really understand what it is. They know it's associated with the brain, for sure, in some way. But they don't understand how this few pounds of jelly inside our skulls can transmute sensations of the outside world into inner experiences, emotions, feelings, thoughts. We really don't know how that works. It's not that scientists are beginning to get an idea. They actually don't have a bloody clue. They have no idea what consciousness is. And in the absence of facts, a number of scientists, Richard Dawkins, for example, the author of The God Delusion, the Orwellian title Professor of the Public Understanding of Science is his, they absolutely believe and state as though it were a fact that consciousness is simply an epiphenomenon of the brain, that the brain is primarily there to help us negotiate this material world as sort of intelligent robots, and that our consciousness is just an accidental byproduct of that, and it's completely meaningless, actually, in terms of the materialistic scientific framework. It is just produced by the brain, and they believe when the brain dies, our consciousness dies also. I absolutely oppose this point of view. Firstly, because there is no evidence for it, and secondly, because it does not accord with my own experiences and the experiences of others concerning the mysterious nature of reality. And it's one of the reasons why I open the book, pretty much, with a near-death experience, where the modern character in Los Angeles, Leone, has taken a drug overdose, in this case one of those prescription drugs called OxyContin that are abused in our society. She's taken a drug overdose, she's dead, and her consciousness doesn't die. It leaves her body, and it travels through a tunnel of light into a parallel world. Now, that is not fantasy on my part. That is based on thousands and thousands of reports of what are called near-death experiences. I've just been reading recently a stunning report of a near-death experience that goes back as far as Plato. It's in Plato's Gorgias, and it tells the story of a soldier called Er, who was killed on the battlefield. And 3 days later, just as they were about to put him on the funeral pyre, he jumped up he returned to life, and he had had the most incredible near-death experience, which he describes in great detail. And so what's interesting to me is that when people are actually flatlining on the ECG and are regarded as clinically dead, they are nevertheless continuing to have vivid experiences. And there are cases on the record, the famous case of the tennis shoe, which I do allude to in one scene in Entangled. A woman died in the operating theater in an American hospital. She was flatlined. They believed she was dead. They were struggling to recuperate her using electric shock to jolt her back to life. And, and during this period, when she was regarded as clinically dead, her body left her soul, as it were, left her body, looked down on the situation in the operating theater, was later able to describe exactly certain details of the operating theater that she should not have seen. She rose up through three floors of the hospital, exited from a window, and on a window ledge around the corner from the window, she saw a tennis shoe lying there. And she described the tennis shoe in perfect detail, including a little bit of chewing gum stuck on the undersole and the color of the laces afterwards, when suddenly she came back to life in the operating theater. This suggests to me very strongly that our consciousness is not produced by our brains, that the brain rather is better understood as a transceiver or a receiver of consciousness, rather in the way that a television set receives a signal from a remote broadcasting station. You know, if we're sitting watching our television and we pick up a brick and throw it through the screen of the TV, the picture's going to go, of course. But we'd be totally wrong to say that we've destroyed the signal.
Right.
We haven't. We've just destroyed the local reception of the signal. The signal's still there. And that's the suggestion, really, that I have about consciousness, and which runs all the way through this novel, Entangled, is that our consciousness may indeed separate from our bodies, and that once it's separate from the body, it is not tied to any particular time or place. It becomes free, and it can move through both time and space. And really, this notion of the non-locality of consciousness, despite materialist scientists kicking up against it, is enormously gaining ground. And I do believe that it is going to be found to be true. So we must not think, for example, when a person is on their deathbed and they're silent and they seem to be in a coma, we must not think that they cannot hear what we say or respond to us. Physically, they may not be able to respond, but I've come to realize that they are present with us in that room, in their consciousness, and that we must take account of that. Consciousness is one of the greatest mysteries of science.
So what do you think, happen in terms of, if we go back to that time again, when you talked about the, basically the invention of cave art, when these people who were around, either if they were us or if they were the proto-human beings, the Neanderthals or what have you, there's something that happened there that suddenly kind of, it's like consciousness entered into the minds of those people at that time. You know,
it's why I called the nonfiction book Supernatural. It's why I gave it the subtitle Meetings with the Ancient Teachers of Mankind. I believe that that's the time, having been locked in the material realm for hundreds of thousands, millions of years of evolution. You see, you can trace the human story back quite far in terms of physical appearance. The last common ancestor of the chimpanzee and of modern humans is dated to about 6 or 7 million years ago. And you don't get anatomically modern humans until about 195,000 years ago. And they don't suddenly start to behave like humans until 40,000 years ago or less. And at the same time they start to behave like humans, that's when we get evidence that they've been exposed to psychedelic plants. It's at that very moment. The connection is as clear as that. To borrow a line from Timothy Leary, I'm suggesting that our ancestors were literally turned on by psychedelics, that they expanded and opened our minds and took us out of 6 million years of utter boredom. and plunged us into an exciting, creative, spirit-imbued new realm. This is the very time they start painting these strange therianthropic beings on the cave walls. That's the time they start burying their dead as well, and they start burying their dead with food and with water. When people do that, you know that they believe that some aspect of the individual does not die when the physical body dies, that some aspect of the individual continues. And I have to ask myself, where did they get this idea from all of a sudden, out of the blue? Could it be from the same place that they got the idea of creatures that are part animal and part human and that transform from one to another, which we know is the place in our heads that is opened by these entheogenic so-called psychedelic plants? And I came to the conclusion that yes, it is. And actually, if you look at other periods of enormous creativity in the human story, for example, the 1960s, you will find that psychedelics actually played an enormous and constructive role. Some people are willing to speak about this, about the role that psychedelics have played in their lives. Steve Jobs, for example, the owner, the founder of Apple, has stated absolutely that his LSD experiences as a young man were fundamental in the burst of creativity that led to the creation of Apple. And he and Wozniak would actually, when they interviewed programmers, one of the questions they asked them was, have you taken a psychedelic before? Because having taken a psychedelic for them was a good sign that this person would be a brilliant programmer. In fact, it was almost like a job requirement at one point. And Wozniak and Jobs have both spoken out openly and honestly about this. Likewise, amazingly, Francis Crick,
yes,
who I've discussed it before, one of the two scientists who discovered the double helix structure of DNA, it emerged after his death. He had confided in a friend that it wasn't, the beer at the Eagle Pub in Cambridge where he and Watson used to go for a drink that gave him the inspiration for the double helix. It was a vision that he saw under the influence of LSD. So I think that these demonized, sadly attacked plants, which our society has so turned itself against, may actually contain the seeds of salvation of our society today. We're in terrible trouble. It's obvious the industrialized world, the technological world, is in a complete mess. We don't know what on earth we're doing or why we're here or where we're going. Look at the violence, the ugliness, the evil. My book is about a demonic battle of good against evil, and you can see that battle of good against evil unfolding in the 21st century as we speak in the worst possible ways. Never has there been a time when human beings have been more cruel or awful to each other on such a gigantic scale as we are today. And this is very clear. Now, what is it? What's gone wrong with the Western world? When I sat down with shamans in the Amazon and asked them that very question, they said, it's extremely straightforward. The West has severed its connection with spirit. You have to reconnect with spirit, or you're doomed. And this is the time we live in. We live in a time when the triumphs of science have persuaded many of us that there is no mystery left. And at the same time, when the dead hand of the old monotheistic religions, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, lie across the world, not as an influence for good, but as an evil force, when these mainstream religions, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, have such a grip on the human imagination that as they have done through the ages, that they can persuade people to kill in the name of that religion. It's not just Islam. Christianity did it for hundreds of years. Look at those terrible burnings at the stake that Christians inflicted on innocent people. Look at the horrors, even now, that unfold within the secret kitchen of the Catholic Church. These big religions, I have to say, I'm sorry, I may offend some of your listeners, but these big religions are not nurturing us spiritually.
Nope.
I believe they are misleading us spiritually. And what the shamans in the Amazon say, it's desperately important that we connect, that we reconnect to the realm of spirit, and that we do so sooner rather than later, because we will plunge the whole world down with us if we do not. And for the shamans in the Amazon, it really is quite a simple answer. And that is, we need ayahuasca. And actually, I agree with them. I would say that, anybody who stands for the job of President of the United States or Prime Minister of this or that country, I would say that anybody who stands for that job, and I don't mean to be facetious here, that that person should have a requirement to have logged at least a dozen sessions of ayahuasca first. Because if that person has logged a dozen sessions of ayahuasca, they will not be quite so sure about their prejudices, not quite so certain about their cruel instincts. They will begin to have some doubts about their course in life, and those doubts will be very helpful for all of us.
Is it a basic story again of knowledge versus ignorance, and where our society has ended up, so to speak, is in the, on the side of ignorance, do you think?
I think yes. In fact, it's interesting that many of the ancient texts equate ignorance with evil. I'm not speaking of ignorance of book learning here.
Sure.
I'm speaking of ignorance of the fundamental nature of things. And we are brainwashed to believe that our function as living creatures in modern society, we're brainwashed to believe that our function is primarily about show, about appearance, about consumption. How much do we consume? How conspicuously do we consume it? We define ourselves in terms of material goods and products. We do not define ourselves in terms of our inner landscape. Many of us have been persuaded that either it's a matter of simple blind faith in the dogma of one of the three monotheistic religions in order to secure our afterlife destiny, or else people have been persuaded that there is no afterlife destiny, that nothing happens, that we're just lumps of meat, and when we're dead, and that's the end of it. Neither of these two positions are facts. What the ancient texts all tell us, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, the ancient Egyptian Book of the Dead, for example, is that when we die, our consciousness does continue, and that it must make a journey after death, and that we must account for everything we've done with this life when we undertake that journey, that we will indeed be called to account. And it's often symbolized as a set of scales in ancient Egypt in which the heart is weighed against the feather of truth and cosmic justice. And the fundamental, there's many issues in this judgment. One of them, it's necessary but not sufficient, is being a good person, being a wicked, cruel person. Inflicting violence and misery on others will always lead you to real problems in your afterlife journey. But being a good person is not enough. You must do something with this precious gift you were given of a human body and a human brain, the ability to choose between good and evil, the ability to use your consciousness to explore mysteries. The message seems to be, don't waste that gift that you were given. You were given it for a reason, to develop yourself as an eternal being, not to set yourself back. You were put into this life to learn and to grow and to develop. Did you use that gift well? That also seems to be the message, and it's a message which our society today never gives us, and it's a question that our society never asks. In fact, I would go so far as to say that Western technological society is a vast, sophisticated device for sending the huge majority of humanity to sleep.
Yes.
For keeping us in a state of unconsciousness.
See, this goes back to those demonic forces, basically, that you mentioned before as well. This idea of being fearful of death, and in the extension of that, is basically that keeps humanity weak, and that serves a purpose in our hierarchy, in the system of control.
You're right. You're absolutely right. I mean, our hierarchy does seek to control death as well, and to set certain definitions for it. It is part of the mechanism of control, that the whole attitude of the population to death should be structured in a certain way. The simple message, I guess, that I would like to get across, and that I have tried to get across in between the lines of the adventure story in Entangled, is that death may not be the end. It could be the beginning of the next great adventure. And like any great adventure, if we're going to go into it, we should be as well prepared as possible. We should equip ourselves with knowledge about this subject. And the only people in the world today who really have true and profound knowledge of the mystery of death are not scientists in Western technological societies. They're the shamans in hunter-gatherer and tribal societies still surviving all around the world. And if their advice is not enough for us, we may go back to the ancient texts. I mentioned the ancient Egyptian Book of the Dead. I mentioned the Egyptian, the Tibetan Book of the Dead. We may go back and learn also from them about this great mystery that awaits us all. Because you know, the ancient Egyptians and the Tibetans, the ancient Egyptians devoted their best minds, you know, for 3,000 years to exploring that mystery. What happens to us when we die? Our society, of course, we devote our best minds to making new kinds of cars and washing machines and airplanes. I know who I'd rather listen to.
And not even that anymore. I mean, look at the progress of things, the so-called progress. We're still driving around with the combustion engine and things like that. You think we'd be way more ahead at this stage?
Of course, except we're locked in by particular interest groups.
Of course, yes.
Demonic forces, if you'd like. And again, that's why the battle of good and evil and the presence of a demon is an important part of the story in Entangled. I'm sure you know the Gnostic texts and the Hermetic texts, which go back to the end of ancient Egypt and the time of the beginning of Christianity. And there's a particular Hermetic text attributed to the god Hermes, who was the Greek form of the ancient Egyptian wisdom god Thoth. And he kind of makes a prophecy projecting forward into the future, looking really to our time. And he speaks of a time when the gods will have departed from the earth, and only, he says, evil angels will remain, mingling with mankind and driving the poor wretches to all manner of crimes and horror. That's our society today, agitated by evil angels, uncertain of who we are. And yet within all of us, a yearning, a hope, a sense that things can be made better, that some kind of transformation of consciousness may just be underway. When these things happen, they can happen very, very fast. And so I suppose my overall position on this is one not of hopelessness, but of hope. I believe in the human spirit. I'm confident if we can take, again, control of our own consciousness rather than handing the keys of it to others, we can still make the world better.
All right. Graham is behind such books as The Sign and the Seal, Underworld, Talisman, Fingerprints of the Gods, just to mention a few there. But Graham, to run things up for this first segment here, tell our listeners how to, first of all, get to your website, of course, to check out more sources there, but also how to they pick up a copy of your latest book, Entangled.
Okay. Well, the website is grahamhancock.com, grahamhancock.com. And when you go into www.grahamhancock.com, right on the entry page, there's a button that will take you straight to material on Entangled, or you can enter the main site. It's all in the main site anyway. In terms of buying Entangled, at the moment, it's only published in Britain. And it's available on amazon.co.uk. We have the links up on my website. And it will be published in the US in October and also in translation in Italy and a number of other countries in October. But right now it's only the UK edition that we have out there. But, it's available on Amazon UK right now.
Excellent. GrahamHancock.com, that is the main website. Again, stay with us, Graham, and we'll be right back with more after this. That's our first hour with Graham Hancock, and we've only just scraped the surface, really. We are going to proceed talking with Graham in hour two for our members. And we have so much more to talk about in terms of Supernatural, Entangled, and also Fingerprints of the Gods and Talisman. We begin to talk about the end and the cyclical nature of civilization, and how fragile Western society is with its specialization and a level of general intelligence that seems to be going down and not up. We talk about inventions of a mind induced by so-called vision drugs and various theories on when man first came into contact with the psilocybin, mushrooms, Amanita muscaria, and soma, plants and substances that might have helped to spark the mind of ancient man. We carry the discussion over to the preservation of shamanic tradition and gnosis, knowledge, and discuss the Gnostics, Cathars, Knights Templar, and leading this into or up to Freemasonry, Rosicrucians, and we get Graham's take on the fruits of these societies and secret societies. We talk about the destiny of America, the New Atlantis, the intention of the founding fathers of the USA. We discuss sacred cities, sacred faith, and how Egyptian civilization seemed to have been supplanted around the world with alignments of monuments and buildings to stars in the heavens. We also ask if this philosophy can be found in modern times with cities such as Astana in Kazakhstan that have pyramids and spectacular monuments that seem to stem from the same tradition and religious beliefs. We talk about the philosophy of some of the architects, and we also get Graham's take on the alien intervention theory from people such as Daniken, Sitchin, Lloyd Pye, and others. Don't miss the second hour coming up for Red Ice members. Click on members, log in, or sign up to download or stream hour 2. When you sign up, you get instant access to our archives of radio, TV, webcasts, video interviews, films, audio commentary, and much more. RedIceCreations.com is the website, and don't miss our upcoming Red Ice TV episode on Illuminati symbolism in movies, available soon. Also, of course, check out our radio archive for more free and members radio. There you can also see our upcoming guests. We have good stuff in the pipeline for you. But now we're focusing on hour 2 with Graham Hancock.